now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to The Times. To find out more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and today I am really excited because James Scowcroft joins me in the studio. And down the line, we're so lucky, we don't have just one person down the line. We have two people down the line. One of them, James Ducker, who was at the Etihad, where he got to witness that shellacking from Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool. And the other one is Rory Smith. Now, he's been away for a while. He's been traveling the globe. And, of course, we welcome him back, and we're very excited to have him. We'll be talking about events at White Hart Lane, as well as what the future holds for Bale and Ronaldo. See, I'm throwing it forward. See what I'm doing there? Let's chat about the continuing Klopp factor. Ducker, you were at the game. This is kind of like the idealized Klopp, the Klopp of early Borussia Dortmund. High counter pressing at the right times, these speedy guys who torture defenders, right?
Yeah, I think so. Those that maybe haven't seen a lot of Dortmund and Klopp's teams, you know, down the years, but have, you know, read about him, heard about him, they watch that game and think, ah, this is what everyone's going on about. This is what he means about hunting in packs high up the pitch and sort of swarming all over opponents. And Liverpool did that extremely well. It was very interesting listening to sort of Klopp afterwards. He was at pains really to encourage sort of patience and a lot of perspective, and kept going on about how, hang on a minute, we lost 2-1 against Palace the previous a couple of weeks earlier. And I think that was very sensible, particularly because it was about as bad a performance as I think I've ever seen from Manchester City under Arab ownership. They were so bad that I think that has to.
We'll get to City in a moment. I just want to keep it with Liverpool now. Scully, when you watch this, the obvious, and then we see the highlights of Match of the Day, and they showed us, you know, look how well they're pressing. Did you ever play on teams that pressed high up the pitch aggressively? Is it really that tiring and unpleasant? I mean, when it works, they make it look so easy.
Yeah, I played for a team for a manager that wanted to press high up the pitch.
And okay, I think you could name names. You haven't played for that many managers.
No, sorry, this was at Leicester. It was actually in the Premier League. And we had a problem. It was the season of Arsenal's Invincible. So there were some very good teams.
Who was your manager?
Mickey Adams was the manager. And we played in a high-pressing team. And at the start of the season, it worked. But when teams sort of figured us out a little bit, and played against the press, played away. So if you can break that first line and you can take four or five players out of the game, your back four is so exposed, it's untrue. And in the end, it cost us relegation. Where if we'd have actually sat back, I think we'd have probably stayed up because we had enough. Will it work for Liverpool? I think if you go to a Manchester City, you look a little bit jaded, a little bit half-hearted, which they do a lot. I think that technique, that tactic works, but I just think at home, where teams are going to drop and defend deep, you're going to leave yourself very exposed at the back, i.e. like Palace exposed them 2 weeks ago.
Rory, are you surprised that he did this so aggressively away from home? Or do you think that maybe he kind of felt, man, it's City away, why don't we try this? I won't start Benteke, I'll have the little guys running around. And even if we lose this game, it's almost like we've sort of budgeted for a loss, and it'll be part of the learning experience.
I take your point. I'm not sure I necessarily agree. It is one of those games where maybe he looked at it and thought, right, we have to try and do something because on paper City are better. But I think what Scully said is right. I think that there are circumstances where a pressing game is the best way to defend. And that against a side like City, even when they're playing relatively well, not obviously if they're at their very best and they're a different proposition, but if they play relatively well, you press them, there are the opportunities there to press as they want to build the play. The problem that Klopp will have and has had to an extent against Palace is he's got to find a way for Liverpool to break down teams that are just sitting deep. And that's not just been a problem for Liverpool themselves recently. It was a problem for Klopp at Dortmund last season, mitigated by injuries to an extent. But that's where he has to find a plan B. He has to find a way of... I mean, pressing should work, I guess, against a team sitting deep, but he has to find a way of making it work against a team sitting deep.
Well,
that's not to say he can't do that, and I think that the impression from Saturday obviously was overwhelmingly positive.
Relying on people to make mistakes when you press, basically, yeah. Aren't you? So that's good. That's a big part of football, but ultimately as well, to win games of football, you've got to have more than that. You've got to have more than that in your locker. You've got to be able to break teams down. You've got to be able to play around players, to keep possession, to slow the game down at times, and you know that's ultimately going to be Klopp's challenge.
Well, that was partly what he tried to do last year. He tried to transition from a game that was so reliant on the counter pressing to a game where, especially against weaker opponents, they could be perhaps a little more multifaceted and not rely on pressing. Because I think the other thing he realized is that it takes a lot out of you over time. And Rory, I guess it's an inevitable debate, but there's a school of thought that says, well, I don't want Christian Benteke pressing, and you know, I look at these players, and does he have the guys to do that? Who can physically do that, you know, on a more regular basis?
Yeah, he's got players who I think are suited to it in terms of Coutinho and Lallana and Firmino. Whether Benteke and Sturridge, I guess they'd be your two big question marks. Can they do it regularly and effectively from the front? Sturridge did it under Rodgers in the 2013-14 season when Liverpool pressed very high as well. Benteke, I think, is a more rounded player than he's given credit for. But what has occurred to me is that that might be the answer to the initial problem, which is that Liverpool do need to find another way of playing. They need to find a way of attacking sides who are prepared to sit deep, who won't come and play, who won't have the possession in positions where they can make mistakes that Liverpool can benefit from. And perhaps the answer to that is in Benteke and Sturridge, and that when you're at home against a bottom half of the table side, maybe you play those two and you kind of change the focus of your play a little bit, and you don't rely so heavily on just pressing. You have a more kind of front foot approach. So it may be that Liverpool, for all that he doesn't have the quality of the squad he had at Dortmund a couple of years ago, maybe he has a more kind of multifaceted squad, I guess.
I mean, I think obviously there are times when you need to press, but the reason generally, as Scobie said, the reason I'm not a huge fan is that if you know what you're doing, you figure the opposition out. The amazing thing with you can break a press with a bad team simply lumping the ball into space, or you can break the press with a good team if you have skillful players who can pass through the press, or you can just end up fouling people, which is what happens when you press a lot and picking up yellow cards. So it's really, really difficult to do, and I think Klopp's Liverpool, I mean, I think he was right to come out and sort of dampen enthusiasm. Because until they learn this properly, it's not going to be like this every week, is it?
It's not. It's not at all. And I think what Scully and Rory were saying is that in some perverse way almost, is that he might have better success playing a high sort of high line and a high pressing game against those sides that are determined to pass through sort of regardless of the opponents that they're playing, the likes of City, obviously the likes of Chelsea, Spurs perhaps, maybe Manchester United. They'll probably have more success on that front than against sides who would be prepared to try and take out the first line by lumping it into a target man or lumping it down for sort of fast wingers to chase.
But James, you know, I think Man City played to their downfall a little bit at the weekend as well. But if you're playing against a team that are going to press, and what they did well, Liverpool, is they set a little bit of a trap, so they just drop off a bit, throw it out the back, right, now we're going to come. And I just think Man City were just a little bit naive at times playing against a Liverpool side like that.
I think we were more than that naive. I just think it was a individual and collective shambles, and that sort of back four, I looked at that back four before the game and I thought, that looks a recipe for disaster. And so it proved, and Mangala's not comfortable on the ball. They were in Rush Street, Sanyu came out after the game and said that his mind and body weren't right after the Paris terrorist attacks and shouldn't have played, which is a whole other story. I think it was just a dreadful, dreadful performance by them. And I couldn't talk about it earlier, but I do think any praise for Liverpool, as well as they did play, has to be informed in part by how sort of risible City were.
Okay, well, let's inform that now. Rory, I think like me, you're a big Manuel Pellegrini fan. I look at this and bearing in mind that there might be injuries or whatever else, but, you know, they're playing in the Champions League. They've already qualified, and they have a dead rubber coming up. We never quite know what condition players are in when they come back from international breaks, but obviously Kompany was out. Otamendi, for one of the two centre halves, seems like a very obvious solution. Fernandinho in place of Fernando. Fernandinho's, I think, arguably been one of their better players this year. Seems like a very obvious solution. I don't know who that was impersonating Yaya Toure on the pitch in his first 45 minutes, but it's probably as bad as he's been since coming to City. This is all stuff for which we blame the manager, right?
Yeah, it is. I think there's. I think the first thing to say is that City, you know, there is this. There has always been this suspicion that when Silva doesn't play, when Kompany doesn't play, when Aguero doesn't play, or when any combination of those three don't play, that City aren't anywhere near what they can be. I think that's given the amount of money they've spent and the amount of money they've had available, and also to an extent the time they've had to do it, I think that's astonishing that they're still in that situation. Teams always rely on players, but City shouldn't be that reliant on those three players. I think there were some strange decisions made, Otamendi being the principal one. But the other thing is that City, they kind of do this, not regularly, but there's always a chance with City that they're going to turn up and be a little bit slapdash. It does happen. And it's characterised them under Pellegrini, it characterised them under Mancini, it characterised them under, going back to Mark Hughes, you know, just occasionally they'd have these games where they just don't really turn up. And I'm not quite sure why it is. I mean, you kind of have your own theories and how legitimate they are, I'm not sure, but James watches them a lot more than I do, but every so often, it's not like, you know, United under Ferguson or the good Chelsea under Mourinho, where you think, right, they're going to turn up, they will be at it. City, there is always a chance, not a 50-50 chance, but like a 1 in 5 chance, that they'll just turn up, decide they're not bothered and be terrible.
Ducker, do you understand what Rory's saying? Is he right or is he talking nonsense?
No, I mean, I have felt, I've been watching sort of City at close quarters for, you know, a long time now, and particularly, you know, with great interest since the ownership change, is that they are capable of moments of just sort of breathtaking football, and times you watch them and you think that this team should just go on and dominate domestic football and certainly have a good stab at it in Europe, and then the running through them just seems to be this occasional fatal flaw. What surprised me on Saturday is I admire Pellegrini's sort of real attacking ethos and, you know, desire, once he's got, you know, one goal to go and get a second, and once he's got a second to go and get a third, and once he's got a third to go and get a fourth. I really like that about him. But I also think that there were signs, that there have been some signs this season of him allying that sort of attacking sensibilities with a greater pragmatic streak. And you saw it against Seville, you know, Fernando and Fernandinho, you know, in Toure in midfield, and gave him a much stronger base. I thought they were absolutely outstanding in that game. They did it again against Villa. It was 0-0, but how they didn't win that game, I don't know. So I didn't understand going into this game, even if Fernandinho and Otamendi had long journeys back, why he didn't go with a midfield three again, which had been so successful. I don't know whether it's a stubborn streak or maybe something has happened with Fernandinho and Otamendi that, you know, we're not yet aware of. I mean, he wouldn't really elaborate on that after the game, which I thought was quite interesting.
Of course, he also had the option of Fabian Delph.
Yeah, he could have played Delph and Fernando. And I think one of the interesting things that was, I mean, I thought it started to happen a lot more over the course of last season, and definitely this season, is Toure, when he has played in a midfield three, has looked far, far more comfortable than he has in a two.
Well, I mean, I think you make some great points there. Probably to some degree, there's also an element that you also have to manage superstars and attacking midfielders. And when you do play the two central midfielders plus Yaya, then you've got one less spot
to accommodate Sterling and De Bruyne and Silva when fit and Nasri when fit.
But
and
he's not
Navas
quite had that
fit.
Issue yet, though, Gab. So, I mean, that is a quandary he's going to have to face when Silva comes back.
No,
clearly, I mean, is he going to play Silva and Yaya? It's going to be one or the other.
Okay, so one-word answers now, please. Rory, are Liverpool making the top four?
No.
Scoey?
No.
Ducker?
No.
All righty. Not much belief.
I'm two games at home all season.
Right, moving on to Spurs and West Ham. Rory, you were there. Tottenham haven't lost since opening day. They looked devastating against West Ham, at least to me, despite the absence of Eric Lamela. No, I jest. There's something coming together here. But before you answer that, can you tell me, am I right thinking that they're playing three consecutive derbies in the league? What kind of goofy scheduling is that?
Well, it's a Premier League scheduling, Gab, which has inbuilt narrative, which is lovely for journalists, but not particularly fair. It's the same scheduling that means that whereas every other country in the world, it goes home, away, home, away, home, away, and then the second half of the season mirrors the first half of the season perfectly. But in England, we don't do that. We have home, away, away, home, 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 away, home, 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 away, away. It's ridiculous. It's totally unnecessarily complicated.
You're a little bit eccentric. You guys are the country that still employs somebody named Black Rod to go and knock on a door, right? So, you know, maybe it's in keeping with that. But tell me, should I be excited about Spurs and our man Poch?
Yeah, you should. No, you really should. And it's funny, going back to your last question, I think the reason that Liverpool won't get the top four is because I think Spurs might. They look completely... They've completely bought into what Pochettino wants them to do. They're very young, which is good, because I think they are, to use the cliche, fearless. I think they have a solid defence. Alderweireld and Vertonghen look like they know what they're doing, look like they understand each other. They've got a very hard-working midfield. They've got a relentlessness in the way they play. They've got a very expressive attack. Harry Kane has rediscovered his golden touch. There is something coming together. I think there'll be bumps along the way. They're not perfect, but they have, in the least Spurs way possible, built a side. And I think that's to Pochettino's enormous credit.
Scoey, I need to ask you about Dele Alli, because obviously, you know, 6 months ago, this guy was playing in League One. Now he's scoring a great goal for England. He's turning more and more into a leader of this Tottenham team. He's barely 20 years old. You must have played with or against guys who've come from two divisions down. And these dudes come in, do they have that fearlessness, or can they go and they can kind of be a little bit afraid? Can you just talk a little bit about the dynamic of guys who are used to being the best player on the pitch and then they go and they face you guys in the Premier League and you're supposed to be better than them?
Yeah, it's actually a very, very good point. And I was at Wembley on Tuesday night and watched him, and I thought he had a very, very good game. And he had a very good game at the Emirates the time before that. I think what's happened, and it's quite interesting at Spurs, because Spurs have got a wonderful academy that they've invested millions of pounds in, and they've got a bundle of midfield players who are technically very, very good. And all of a sudden, this lad has come out of League One, like you say, from NK Dons, overtaken all of those people. And just watching him the other night at Wembley, there was, you know, for his goal, he's got an absolutely smashed Snydlin in midfield, no sort of fear, tackled, and he's just gone on and drove, shot for goal, top corner. So many youngsters now probably wouldn't have tackled because they don't play men's football. If they got the ball, would just pass it to the nearest person. So his experiences of actually playing in League One, like you say, where it is a little bit of rough and tumble, it's actually quite a good high standard now, lower league football. But that sort of 50 games under his belt of playing in stadiums, playing in an atmosphere, playing in a winning side where winning and losing makes a big difference, I think has catapulted him higher than all of this big generation of academy players.
Ducker, do you see his point? I mean, if compare him and, I don't know, a Tom Carroll type or maybe even Ryan Mason, are these guys, they're not necessarily worse in terms of skill than Alli, but Do you see that a guy who plays against adults at a young age might actually have more of a benefit?
I think it has a huge impact. I mean, there's so much. I mean, Scurry will know coaching at sort of under-15s level at Ipswich, you'll see it week in, week out. There's so much emphasis on technique and us being influenced by other sort of footballing philosophies that being more direct is a huge thing, really. There's a really interesting report that UEFA did on the Champions League last year about how, you know, we're breeding less direct, you know, attacking midfielders who like to really run with the ball and not look to pass sideways, but be aggressive and go forward. And I think Dele Alli's got that. I think he's also got, I mean, he's got a bit of needle and menace about him. He's got that sort of inbuilt conviction. I always remember, I haven't obviously not watched a lot of MK Dons, but when they battered United 4-0 in the League Cup game, and Bayern Munich had actually dispatched scouts to go and watch Dele Alli that night, and he was just absolutely ferocious in midfield. I mean, great on the ball when he got it, but he was so aggressive.
West Ham completed 286 passes yesterday, which is probably about right for a wayside. This academy football, I think 2 weeks ago now, we have all the stats these days. My under-15s only play 80 minutes as well, on average complete about 400 passes. So can you see the difference in...
But Andy Carroll doesn't pay for your under-15s. No, do you have an Andy Carroll type on your team?
Yeah, I've got a target man up front.
Right.
Can you see the difference to the point I'm trying to make, though?
Yeah.
Academy football now is pass, 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 possession, everything, which is good, but is it reality? Probably not.
Right. It's an interesting parallel, because I was looking at Ali and trying to sort of figure out, you know, he's so multi-talented. I mean, there were spells when Kane dropped off and he was often the furthest guy up the pitch, and then other times he'd come back and help die in the tackle. Is there a parallel perhaps between him and Ross Barkley, and... who do you like more?
Yeah, I think there probably is. I think it was interesting that Pochettino went for Dembélé alongside Dier rather than Ali alongside Dier, and Dembélé pushed further forward. The parallel is probably that both Ali and Barkley can play a number of roles in midfield, but they will only truly excel, and only both are wonderfully sort of rich in promise, but they'll only live up to that when they are given a specific role to play. That doesn't necessarily need to be now, but at some point, someone needs to decide, you know, is Dele Alli my midfield general who kind of sits a bit deeper, who runs the game? Is he my number 10? He's too good, I think, to be kind of an anchor man. But, you know, he needs to be given a specific set of kind of instructions if he's going to be able to become a specialist at something rather than just a good all-round midfielder, which is what someone like Ryan Mason is. Who do I like more? I don't know. Probably, I'm tempted to say Alli, but then Barkley's also really good. I like both of them a lot.
There you go. Great time to be English then.
So one of them will end up playing on the left wing for England. That's the one thing that'll be certain of.
Did anyone say anything about Christian Eriksen? Because he was absolutely...
Yeah, he was superb. He was superb. So was Dembélé.
He's such a great schemer, isn't he, Eriksen? He just looks a nightmare to play against.
If you see him, you're liable to see him not be that influential as well. There are games when he just looks unplayable, but there are times as well when he's a little bit on the fringes, and he's pretty to watch, but not particularly kind of effective. He's quite ornamental at times, and that's always been the problem with Eriksen. Even back at Ajax, they were never quite sure how much he would definitely run every game. They were never quite convinced.
Who wants to shed some light actually on why West Ham were so poor? Because I actually thought that while Spurs played really well, West Ham were also really quite poor. And it can't just be Payet. I love the fact that Bilic came out and he was just so honest about why they were so bad and so ineffective.
They were okay for the first 20 minutes, and funny enough, just before the first goal, there was another attack, and it kind of broke down because a Spurs player took a pass when he didn't need to take a pass, and the crowd sort of went oh, you know, you can hear that murmur of discontent go around a ground. And I thought, hang on, West Ham might have something here, because Spurs are getting a little bit frustrated. And then they scored. It was a terrible, terrible piece of defending from Carl Jenkinson for the goal. West Ham were complicit, I think, in certainly three of the four goals. Maybe not Walker's, although by that time it looked like they stopped running. But certainly the first three, West Ham really could have stopped. Their form's turned a little bit the last few weeks, hasn't it? West Ham, they've now not won, I think, three. Sounds like really sort of poor analysis. But the first goal just seemed to rob them of all conviction, and that they never really got back from that.
I'm one of the people who watches Match of the Day too. It kind of cycles back to what we talked about earlier with the way Liverpool press, you know, sort of juxtaposing that with the way Spurs press. And they made the point, I think it was Trevor Sinclair and Kasper Schmeichel, that if you're West Ham, maybe instead of playing it out from the back, you know, once in a while, if you just kind of booted it to Andy Carroll, it might not have been a bad idea.
It seems to be like one way, one way, one way only. We won't mix it up at all. And I was watching, I mean, I've not watched the whole West Ham game like Rory, but I was watching it and I just thought, you know, West Ham, they're just doing the same thing all the time.
Yeah.
You're not learning whatsoever. You are getting hounded to death in your sort of own third. You know, try and mix it up a little bit. And like you say, I mean, you know, poofing it up to that.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Andy Carroll, every game is not going to always work, it's not always going to be effective, and people will suss you out. But you would think they would have tried to. I know, obviously, Bilic, West Ham, you know, traditionally they'd like to get it on the floor and play, but I think sometimes you've got to find a way to win in a game.
Well, even,
you've got to find a way to counter something that clearly isn't working. And
even if you do it every third time, it forces them to be less aggressive.
The reason managers don't like that long ball thing is because it is essentially a lottery. You're hoofing the ball forward. There is more of a chance that you will lose it than if you conserve possession, obviously. But that is the way around the press. I remember being at the Clásica, I think two or three years ago, when Bayern won 3-0 at Dortmund, and the way that Bayern won 3-0 at Dortmund was, instead of passing it around, Guardiola told his players to bypass the midfield. So Guardiola said, right, they're going to press us. We know they're going to press us. We go long. That is the way to beat a pressing system.
Yeah, have somebody fast run a guy like Hummels. We're going to move on now to Madrid and the Clásico. By the way, I'm just really curious. Instant poll. I met the chairman of Barry, and he told me that he wasn't going to watch the Clásico. He was going to watch City and Liverpool. Obviously, leaving aside work commitments, and you had no choice. You had to watch City and Liverpool. Which game would you have watched, Ducker?
Don't know. I'd probably be influenced by what my kids wanted to watch. I'd let them pick.
Well, are your kids the kind of people who would rather watch Neymar and Suarez, or are they the kind of people
who would rather go and watch Mangala?
So
they're obviously interested in Neymar, and obviously Messi was on the bench, and Suarez, and
right.
Big names like that. So
they're Barcelona fans, right? Scully? Yeah.
Madrid, Barcelona.
Rory?
I was at home and I watched them, and I flicked between the two, which is a sensible choice.
Yes, I know, but imagine you only have one television and the remote control
Everybody
is broke.
Did that.
No, I don't want to imagine that. That's unrealistic. It's the 21st century. I've got a remote control, got 400 channels. I've watched a little bit of both, and considered flicking it onto Holmes Under the Hammer as well.
There you go. That's an excellent choice. I thought this Clásico was actually more one-sided than the Manita one that Mourinho lost. I just thought it was an absolute beatdown. I wrote a column on this very issue, and it seems to me that you can broadly blame three factors. One is Florentino Perez, which maybe is a little more technical. So if you want, you can read my column. We can talk about that. But the other one is, do you blame the manager for playing a goofy system, or do you blame the players for not showing up? I want to start with you, James, because when you're on the end of such a beatdown, I mean, we assume that the players go on the pitch to try and to execute what the manager tells them to do. And so when stuff like this happens, it's got to be the manager, right?
No, I think it's a combination of a lot of things. I think it's very hard to say to any game or win or loss that it's down to one thing. You know, there's many different factors in football. You know, they make so many changes, Madrid, with managers, with players, etc., etc., that there just isn't the consistency that Barcelona have had over the last few seasons. You know, if you look at, you know, Neymar, how settled he looks because the likes of the Biscuits, the Xavis, the PKs now, they've got a very, very settled side, a very settled squad with a philosophy to play in a certain way, to play in a certain style. And I think that strikes the main one for me. Listen, you can pick out individual things you can say to the manager. The manager is under massive pressure at Madrid, so that pressure is going to wear off onto the players. Where, you know, Barcelona, is the manager under the same kind of pressure? No, not really. There's so many different little factors. You know, for me, just Madrid is just a circus that...
I'll tell you what, if Luis Enrique did not start Lionel Messi, if as a result of that they had lost that game, you can bet that he would have a major issue on his hands, as he has done in the past when he didn't start Messi.
Roy, really?
Yes, you know, this is Luis Enrique we're talking about. They lose that game, then they're level at the top of the table, and that's not good. Rory, I think we both have a soft spot for Rafa, and I'm going to give a little bit of background here for those who don't follow this that closely, but basically Real Madrid are a crazy, lopsided team if you play the 11 most famous players. That was part of the reason Ancelotti struggled at the end, trying to make sense of it. Rafa, in some ways, has had slightly fortunate ride in the sense that James has been injured, so he could play Casemiro and give some semblance of order to the side. In this game, he fielded a lineup that was completely incoherent, and it looked like exactly like the Panini sticker lineup that his president, Florentino Perez, would have fielded. Toni Kroos and Luka Modric in midfield on their own, being bombarded. Gareth Bale in the hole. James and Ronaldo on the flanks, Ronaldo unhappy. There is a school of thought that says this was Rafa's way of saying, see, Mr. President, I'll do things your way, and this isn't going to work. And in fact, it didn't work. Do you buy into that?
That would be a very, very risky ploy. And I mean, Rafa's not averse to a little bit of political shenanigans, but I think that even that is probably a little bit Machiavellian. And
okay, but then that means that Rafa thought that this was the best possible lineup and approach tactics, and he really thinks it's a good idea to play Gareth Bale in the hole.
No, I suspect that's not true either. I think the truth probably lies somewhere in between, which is that the problem that Madrid have got, and Stoey touches on it, I think that Barcelona is just as pressurised an environment. It's set when things are going well, when obviously there's less. The pressure you're free of pressure when things are going well at both clubs. When as soon as things even vaguely go badly, I mean, Rafa went into this game under pressure. They'd only lost once in the league, hadn't they, before Saturday. I think what Rafa probably did, as other managers have done at Real Madrid before him, is field the best team he could to cope not only with the pressure to win the game from the fans, from the players, from the fact that it's Real Madrid, but to cope with the fact that you have to keep Florentino happy. So I certainly don't think Rafa played that team thinking, right, these lot will get battered and it'll prove a point for me. That doesn't work with Florentino. He's not going anywhere. But I think he probably did feel that he had to include all of those names because that's what Florentino wants. And that's a real problem at Madrid. That there is something about Real Madrid at the moment that makes you wonder if it is essentially unmanageable as a club. Not only the fact that Perez sacked Ancelotti basically for the sake of sacking Ancelotti, which was a ridiculous decision in the first place. Not only because the fans demand constant victories and some sort of style, but also they realise that they don't have the players to play in the way that Barcelona do, and then they liked Mourinho, who didn't play with any real style either, and the fans seem to want something that's quite kind of nebulous and doesn't really exist. And then you've got the fact that the players seem to be able to be ready to kick off at their manager at any point, and it is a crazy situation. And look, Rafa, it looked to me, watching half of the game and the other half of the City game, looked to me like Rafa got his system wrong, no question about that. It also looked to me like the players weren't trying desperately hard, certainly after the first couple of goals. But you wonder, is there a manager out there who could actually get, I don't know, who can deal with that situation? Mourinho kind of did, but kind of didn't.
But Mourinho had different players. Mourinho had a more rational squad. This squad is completely, completely irrational.
You can't win every game of football. No team's ever done it. So you're going to lose games. So when you do, like now, it's all, the world's ended, blah, blah, blah. You've got to get on with it.
Ducker, there's a school of thought that says that ultimately it'll come to a head and that Gareth Bale and Cristiano Ronaldo cannot coexist in the same team, mainly because you have two guys who really contribute almost nothing defensively, at least at this stage of his career and with this manager. And so therefore, one of them will be sold. And so I saw Louis van Gaal talking about Cristiano. It struck me, and my interpreter, you probably know a lot more about this because you're closer to Van Gaal, that it was a case of, you know, somebody asking him for the 99th time, would you consider signing Cristiano Ronaldo? And eventually Van Gaal comes out and says, yes, I would, because he'd be an idiot not to, rather than going and hiding behind some stupid, meaningless cliche the way most managers do. And than I'm probably right to do, given our reaction in the media. Am I right here? Is that all it was?
I don't know. Sometimes I think with the likes of Mourinho and Ferguson, there's a lot of strategic answering of questions. I think with Van Gaal, I don't really think there is. I think if he wants to answer something, he'll just answer it. And I don't really think he puts too much thought onto the deep layers of reasoning behind that. He's been asked the Ronaldo question before, and he's answered it in not a dissimilar fashion, saying he's a brilliant player.
So why do we make such a big deal out of this? I mean, he's stating the obvious. It's kind of like if you said, hey, Louis, would you want to spend the weekend with Kate Upton? He'd say yes.
Yeah, but well, I mean, I think that's just another discussion, Gab. I think a lot of United fans will be interested in their manager saying that I'd like to sign Cristiano Ronaldo. I think, you know, I still think that qualifies as a story.
James, this has run on for years, though, hasn't it, this story? It's almost boring now.
I think that one of the bigger issues is United, you know, they've wanted to sign this Galactico sort for a long, long time, and they haven't been able to pull it off yet. And I think a lot of fans are thinking, realistically, looking over the last few years, if we are going to get one next summer, is a chance. And if we can't get one then, can we ever actually deliver one of these players? And I think there's another chain of thought, is that he got a very, very high-profile player in Di Maria and couldn't manage him and sold him. So God knows how he would manage Ronaldo.
Do you not think, James, there's a little sort of United are starting to turn into a Real Madrid, i.e. the way they go and sign players? For me, Ronaldo wouldn't fit into United. I'm not quite sure where you'd play him. Wouldn't fit into Van Gaal's philosophy.
I think there is. I mean, United will say, well, you know, Van Gaal's given debuts to 29 players and we're still committed to youth and everything, but I think the next sort of year, 18 months, will tell us a lot more about which direction that club is headed. And I think, I mean, the man running the sort of club now is steeped in the commercial elements of the club, and he's made no attempts to hide how much easier it is to sell and strike sponsorship deals and market things when you've got a Cristiano Ronaldo or a Neymar or a Bale type as a figurehead at the sort of top of the club. It makes everything so much easier. And I mean, by the same token, as they have deferred so much to Van Gaal and given him so much that he wants, that they will also say, well, the players we sign come down to the manager and not the executiveship. And I definitely think that's the case.
Well, I mean, this is an argument for a whole other time, but this is part of the insanity here, where you've got Van Gaal's only going to be around one more season, right? He's said that every which way. And if you're going to go and sign a Bale or a Cristiano, you'll be committing enormous amounts of money for a lot of time. So maybe it shouldn't just be the manager deciding that. I think they're both going to end up staying, or certainly Cristiano will, because for the simple reason, there aren't too many places where he can go. I can't see Cristiano going to United and playing under Van Gaal for a year. I just don't see how that would work. He's obviously, you know, Arsenal are going to spend money on him. City have a bazillion attacking players. He's not going to move to Barcelona. The only option is Paris Saint-Germain, which is a little bit depressing, frankly, if you're Cristiano. Plus at PSG, who knows? There's the risk that Mourinho might rock up there one day. And with Bale, too. Is Bale what Manchester United need? Is Bale a Van Gaal type player, a guy who'd fit into the system? What's your view?
My view, it's similar to yours. I think it's been a very kind of easy narrative, oh, Ronaldo and Bale can't play together. That's not necessarily what you hear from Madrid. There doesn't seem to, it's not like there's any great personal tension between them. I think there's a difficulty getting them both on the same side to an extent, but I don't think it's the case that they kind of resent each other. I'm the same. I know what you mean about PSG and Ronaldo, but do you not think that the key figure to all of that, including the does Mourinho rock up there, is George Mendes, who runs European football? So I'm sure he'll be able to sort that out in some way.
Well, that's the fascinating thing, isn't it, right? Well, what if, because we fear George Mendes, right? You don't want to be in a situation where you have to find a home for Ronaldo and Mourinho at the same time.
Especially
right?
If there's only one club. There is only one club.
Exactly. Well, I suppose you can persuade Mourinho to take a sabbatical and send him to United, and then you can send Cristiano to Paris Saint-Germain. Look, this is what football's become. You think Ed Woodward makes decisions? You think Peter Lim makes decisions? You think these clubs make the decisions? Increasingly, it's one man. It's one man moving his little pieces across the European board game. It's like the board game Risk. He just moves his little bits around. Right, enough Real Madrid, and I apologize in advance for this foray away from the Premier League. Won't happen again for a while. Let's do some quick hits instead. Arsenal stumble against West Brom, and to make matters worse, they lose Francis Coquelin for an extended period. Ducker, given that they're not exactly teaming with defensive midfielders, is this where their title challenge grinds to a halt?
Well, that would suggest that they were realistic title challenges, and I've never been deeply convinced about that.
Ouch.
Yes, they've got a lot of players out, Arteta, midfielders out, Arteta, Ramsey, Wilshere, etc. But if you are depending on the likes of Coquelin for a title challenge, then no.
It's a really good point. It's like you lose Francis Coquelin, you're like, uh-oh, we're screwed now. I mean, we're not talking Alexis Sanchez or Mesut Ozil. Bizarro. No Martial, no Rooney, so Memphis steps into the front role and Manchester United actually play reasonably well, at least in my opinion, as they take all 3 points against Watford. Scoey, are you encouraged? Are things starting to look up, or are you going to be all sort of northern and Scholesy and gloomy about this?
I'm going to follow the line of Paul Scholes. It was extremely hard work at the weekend. United had to rely on De Gea once again to pull off a couple of saves, did their best to throw it away, and I was told it was their first injury time winning goal since the post-Fergie era, but I do believe the goal was on 89 minutes, 56 seconds, so it's probably not quite. A bit like watching paint dry. First half was okay. Big game next weekend.
Chelsea overcome Norwich at home to win only their first league game in more than a month. Diego Costa was the difference maker, but this time, Rory, okay, at the risk of being exposed as a fool like I was with United, I thought they actually looked really, really good, at least relative to their previous outings.
Well, so I didn't see the entire game. Obviously, I'm relying on a highlights tab. But I'm kind of going to say what Scoey said. I thought they looked okay. They looked better. You're right that they looked better than they have previously. It was only Norwich who wouldn't have necessarily expected to get 3 points at Stamford Bridge. But the overall thing I'm drawing from this entire conversation is that your standards are really slipping.
Well, I try to be a positive person, and I try to see the glass as half full. And I thought they played better than they've done in a while. So sue me. And that was against the Norwich side with my man Nathan Redmond back as well. Romelu Lukaku scores two as Everton beat up Aston Villa 4-0. In the process, he scores his 50th and 51st goals. Only four men have reached the 50-goal mark in the Premier League quicker. Their names are Cristiano Ronaldo, Wayne Rooney, Michael Owen, and God, Robbie Fowler. Ducker, which of those guys, if any, will he match or indeed even surpass?
I don't think he will match or surpass any of that quartet, but I don't think that's a...
Not even Michael Owen?
Don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, Owen scored a lot of goals, Gab, still. I mean, he's got 150 goals in the Premier League still. But no, I think he's 22. He'll have a lot more goals in him, and he'll do well. I think the big issue is with any player these days is how long will he actually be around in the league anyway. I mean, he might be here for 2 years, he might be here for six, but wouldn't surprise anyone if he left and went off somewhere new. So I think that's a big obstacle to it, but a lot of good days ahead of him.
A third of the way in, Leicester are top of the table, and Jamie Vardy has scored in 10 consecutive games. Scoey, two questions for you. Are you a little more convinced that your former club can finish in the top four, or at least finish ahead of Chelsea? And given that the actual record is scoring in 12 consecutive games, 10 straight is just for the Premier League era, should we wait to uncork the champagne until Vardy matches one Jimmy Dunn of Sheffield United?
I don't think Leicester will finish in the top four. I think the next six fixtures will sort them out. I think they've got Manchester United, Swansea away, Everton, Liverpool, Chelsea, Man City.
Load of pants.
Yeah, they've got a tough run coming up. Vardy deserves every bit of credit he gets. To score in 10 consecutive games in the Premier League is a fantastic achievement. Just reading, I think every single goal has been in the penalty box as well, 18-yard box. He's almost like an old-fashioned centre-forward.
Like Jimmy Dunn?
Yeah, exactly. You know, do you used to watch Jimmy?
Slightly before my time. No, but I always find this thing humorous, this sort of demarcation that they keep driving home and we keep buying into. I mean, it is a tremendous 10 straight is a tremendous achievement, but you know, I'm glad at least we're talking about this guy.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's wonderful, know. And it's fair play, and I don't think he's got the credit he deserves yet. Claudio Ranieri, I think he should be given. He got a lot of criticism when he came in, and I think now he should get a lot of praise off you guys.
Luis Felipe Scolari, Felipón, may have been a dud at the World Cup, but he achieved something only one other manager in the history of the universe has ever achieved on Saturday. And it came 501 days exactly after that horrible night against the Germans. Rory, you wrote a piece about this. Care to tell us more?
Yeah, so Felipão has won the Asian Champions League with Guangzhou Evergrande. The other man to have not only won two different continental titles, but also won the World Cup is, of course, Marcello Lippi, which suggests that Scolari is in good company. It's obviously a bit of redemption for Scolari himself after the lowest point of his career, but I think the greater significance is that Guangzhou look like they are Asia's first truly globally significant team in terms of the way they have not only changed the transfer market in China and in the rest of Asia, but they're also starting to influence the South American market, they're starting to influence the European market, because they are taking players who would otherwise go to Europe to China. And that is potentially, not necessarily this year or next year, but over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, that could actually be quite important for everybody. So they're probably a team that you should try and become slightly familiar with, because you'll be hearing a lot more about them.
There's a lot of money in China now. Some of the salaries being paid are astronomical.
Well, a couple of things to that. The Chinese economy, by their standards, is slowing down a little bit, but that could be a blip. But the interesting thing is,
still treble what our economy is.
You don't just do it by growth. You do it by per capita GDP, and they're still far behind.
This is why people listen to the game, because we end up talking about the Chinese economy.
No, exactly. But the interesting...
They don't do this on Football Weekly, do they?
They haven't got the knowledge, that's why.
The interesting thing, I think, is... I mean, we've already seen teams in the Gulf and whatnot go and take players from Europe when, you know, at the peak of their career, or really promising guys from South America. Lanzini, of course, ended up going there before coming to West Ham. But obviously with China, you have the critical mass that they could actually create something sustainable, because it's a big country.
I think the MLS, that could actually damage the MLS, because I think all the Gerrards and Lampards in 5-10 years' time will go to China instead of America.
Well, that's what your man Alessandro Diamanti did, of course.
Gab, one for you. Inter Milan are still top of Serie A, but I hear they're finally scoring some goals.
Indeed, they actually scored 4 goals. It's the first time this season that they won a game by a score other than 1-0. They're top of the table on 30 points. They beat Frosinone, who are a newly promoted side, who are approaching the Serie A season as kind of like a fun ride. We'll try to outscore you in every single game, and obviously they leave themselves open at the back, and they're not that good, although they are very fun to watch. And so hence the 4 goals. But I think we'll find out whether Mancini's for real a week from Monday, because they have a top-of-the-table clash up against Maurizio Sarri's Napoli. So
Napoli
stay tuned
going
for that.
Well too.
Napoli, fantastic. My man Higuain, absolutely on fire. He might be the best Argentine center forward in the world right now. Well, Messi's not fully fit, and Aguero's only been back for 1 game, so give it some time.
Fiorentina as well, Gab. Fiorentina doing well.
Fiorentina doing well too. Of course, they were 2-0 up against Empoli, and which is a local derby, and it looked like everybody's freaking out. And my man Nikola Kalinic coming back, scoring 2, and they grabbed a point. So,
and your tip for the Serie A title champions 2016 is?
My original tip was Roma. I'll stick to that. Although they dropped points at the weekend, drawing 2-2 with Bologna. That's all we've got time for today. Many, many thanks to my guests today, James Scowcroft, James Ducker, and making his return after his 4-week suspension from the game podcast. I don't think he was too disappointed about it, because he was gallivanting across Asia and Oceania. It's Rory K. Smith. Please, please, please press that subscribe button. If you do that, you can hear us every single week, which is good, both if you like us, and it's also good if you don't like us, because if you're into masochism, it could actually be kind of kinky. Remember, you can get exclusive football, rugby, and cricket highlights free as part of your subscription if you subscribe to The Times. It's just £12 for a 12-week trial. Search The Times online. Till next week, bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.